Everybody, my name's Chad Spahr, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's only by God's graces, hundreds of God's graces, the 12 steps as they're outlined out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, strong, strong, stern sponsorship, and a dedicated commitment with the persistence to carry the AA message, and most importantly, to try to help others. I haven't had a drink since June the 21st of 2005. Thank you. Happy Founders Day. 84 years ago, it's hard to believe, 84 years ago it started all right here in Akron, Ohio. Two guys got together and they just decided, come to the conclusion that maybe one alcoholic could help another alcoholic stay sober just for that day. Look what it's turned into. Absolutely wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. I want to thank Aaron for asking. It's always an honor and a privilege to give anything back to Alcoholics Anonymous. The fellowship and the program saved my life. I want to thank the committee for asking me to share and allowing me to share my experience, strength, and hope. So it's all good. You know, I'm coming up on 14 years. And it's funny that I say that because this is a big part of my story today. A couple weeks, I'll have 14 years. People will ask me, how long have you been sober? And I'm the type of alcoholic where I like to round up. I round up. I can't just look them in the eye and tell them 13. I got to round 14. And then not even bat an eye at it. And you know what? That's my disease today. And the reason why I say that is because I suffer from the disease of alcoholism. Not alcoholism, alcoholism. It's my pride, it's my ego, it's always having to be first, having to be best, having to be right, that disease of perception. And you know, when Bill read How It Works, they should read it twice. They should read it for the new guy that comes in. And I was that new guy when I come in because we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. And when I first come in, that was my disease. But my disease today, they should read it for me. It should say, remember that we deal with alcoholism, cunning, baffling, powerful. So, I believe what I'm supposed to tell you today is how I work on that disease, the isms. You know, and what am I supposed to tell you? What am I supposed to talk about? Yeah. I'll tell you a couple little stories. First off, a couple thousand years ago, there was a guy walking around and he was performing these miracles. He was making blind people see, deaf people could hear, cripples could walk. Probably one of the biggest miracles, he was curing leprosy, which today would be like almost curing cancer. And he came back home one day and his mom said, sit down, we need to talk. And he said, what's the matter? And she said, your best friend passed away. It broke this guy's heart. It broke his heart. But he gave this guy his life back. He gave him his life back. And I guess they had a big party and a big hoop to do and everything like that. And when they were cleaning everything up and they were all going on their separate ways and everything like this, the guy that got his life back, he walked up to that miracle worker and he said, Master, what do I do now? The master looked at him with a smile on his face and he said, just go tell people what happened. Just go tell people what happened. So I believe that what I'm supposed to do, the main object, is to tell you what happened, how I got my life back. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, on page 29, it says, each one of us in our own personal stories in our own general way describes how we found our relationship with God. And I believe the second thing that I'm supposed to do is to tell you how I found a relationship with this God of my understanding that I was afraid of. I was afraid to pray. I didn't want him to find me. I was ashamed of all the stuff that I have ever done. But I'll tell you what, I got a really cool God. And I love him today. And I'm supposed to tell you how I found that relationship. Now, before we pray, we got to set down some ground rules about this God thing. The book also says that it's your own conception of God as long as it makes sense to you. So if I use the word God, you plug your own God in, and that's the right God. Because I'm not here to try to convince you, coerce you, persuade you in any way about my God. So if I use the word God, you plug your own God in, and that's the right God. Okay? All right. So, My first sponsor over here, his name's Mike. Mike told me one time we were talking, and I said, I'm a rotten prayer. Mike, I'm a rotten prayer. He said, don't worry about it. He said, just talk to him. Talk to him like you would talk to me. Tell him what you want. Tell him how you feel. Don't be demanding. Tell him how you feel. Tell him when you're sad. Tell him when you're happy. Tell him everything. Just talk to him. I started doing that. I remember he told me, he says, when you talk to him, you treat him like a gentleman. And gentlemen don't do two things. They don't go where they're not invited, and they don't stay where they're not welcome. So I think it would only be proper and fitting if we bowed our heads, took a moment of silence, and each one of us invite their own personal God to our 84th Founders Day. Let's bow our heads. Lord, help me to set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about others, and everything that I think I know about my own recovery, all for a new experience in you, Lord, a new experience in myself, a new experience in my fellow man, and a definite, much new needed experience in my own recovery. Amen. I had two of the most fantastic parents that a kid could ever have. My mom was a stay-at-home mom, and my father was a workaholic bricklayer. Wasn't an alcoholic, he was a workaholic bricklayer. He worked every chance that he got. He was good at it. He was a good provider. We didn't want for anything. And I'll tell you what, when I was a kid growing up, I idolized my father. I just wanted to grow up and be just like him. My father drank Pabst Blue Ribbon in the long neck bottles. Used to come in that brown flippy uppy thing with the returnable bottles. I see people out there shaking their heads. You know what I'm talking about. Yeah. You tell your age when you start talking about that. But my father would come home with a case of beer on a Saturday afternoon, and it was my job to line those beers up in the refrigerator. I'd have them in their single file, all cocked exactly the same way. I think I was a freeze-dried alcoholic just waiting, because everything always had to be perfect. My father would come home on Monday night after work, and he would say, go get me a beer. And I'd run out to the garage, and I'd grab that bottle of beer, and I'd pop the top on it, and I'd take it in, and I'd give it to my dad. And I would watch my dad drink that beer. I would watch him and just mesmerized at how much he enjoyed it. And I always got the last little swallow. Last little swallow. I always waited for my dad to say, go get another beer. He never did. My father came home and drank one beer. And that was it. I would wait till my mom would go to the grocery store, where she would go somewhere, and I'd be by myself. And I would sneak out in that garage, and I'd grab one of those Pabst, and I'd pop the top on it. 10 years old, hold that pinky out just like my old man did, hand on the hip, man, and I take a big pull of that Pabst, and I'll tell you what, buddy, that's the most disgusting stuff I ever tasted. It was absolutely terrible. Absolutely. I take another big pull. I'd gag on it. I might try three. And my thought was, how could my father enjoy something like this? This stuff is absolutely terrible. And I'd walk over to the garage drain, and I would dump that beer down the drain. I tried a lot of times. I wasted a lot of Pabst. I wasted a lot of Pabst. I can remember when I was old enough to drive, so I was over 16. I was over 16. This was my next big experience with alcohol that I remember. I was up at my best buddy's house. I was walking through the garage, and I looked over on his dad's workbench. He had a 30-pack of Stroh's Fire Brewed Beer, and I stole three of those cans of Stroh's. And I made my mind up that I was going to muscle those three beers down no matter what. Okay. Now, like I said, that freeze-dried alcohol, you tell me or I tell myself I can't do it, I'll prove it to myself that I can do it. I only lived about a quarter of a mile from where my best buddy lived in my parents' house, but I decided I was going to go the scenic route and drink those three beers. I popped the top on that first Stroh's, and I took a big pull of it. Guess what? The Stroh's was worse than the Pabst. Absolutely. But I made my mind up. I muscled that first beer down. I popped the top on the second one. The second one was worse than the first. And I kept it down. And I managed to drink all three of those beers before I got home. Within about a 15-minute period. Pulled in the driveway. Shoved the cans up underneath the seat. I'll throw them away later. I can remember walking across the garage floor. And something happened. Right about where I got to where that drain was, where I dumped all that beer, I call it, I got the magic. I got the magic. Now, I got involved down at the Salvation Army here in Akron early on in my recovery. And I used to go there, and we used to do group participation. And I come to find out, I didn't go there, and just like today, I didn't come here to talk to you, I come here to talk with you. So play along with me. Let's have some fun. Right? I talk about this magic when I was walking across the garage floor. And for me, the magic was who, when they drank, got taller? Who got stronger? Who got better looking? Who could dance? Who could sing karaoke? Here's one for you guys. Who got lubricated lips? You could talk to the girls. And my favorite, who became an expert on many subjects? Yeah. It didn't take me long at an early age to figure out that alcohol was never going to be my problem. Alcohol was going to be my answer. Because how could anything that made me taller, stronger, better looking, fantastic dancer, talk to the girls, sing karaoke, and argue with you about anything on any subject at any time be a problem? Alcohol was never my problem. Alcohol was my answer. Alcohol was always my answer. When I put alcohol in my system, I became the person that you look like. Alcohol made me feel comfortable in my own skin. And I can remember going back to an inventory one time, one of those inventories, and somebody had said, go back as far as you can remember the first time that you felt uncomfortable in your own skin. Kindergarten. I can remember standing there with my mom, holding onto her finger, waiting to go into my kindergarten class, and everybody's running around and getting their lockers and getting their seats and getting their chairs and everything like that. And I'm standing there to myself at the age of 6 years old. I thought, this is not good. This is not good. I don't belong here. I don't feel comfortable. You know, 6 years old, you know what I needed? I needed a drink. I needed a drink. It's tough for a six-year-old his first day of kindergarten to get a double shot of Jack Daniels and a beer backer, but that's what I needed. See, alcohol produced in me a psychic change. It was always wonderful, absolutely wonderful. I didn't become like a daily drinker, you know, all of a sudden. But I come to find out that every time I put alcohol in my system, something happened. And it made me feel better. And I could be anything or anybody that I wanted. And all I had to do, a couple beers, a couple shots, it was the answer. It was the answer. I graduated from high school. I started my apprenticeship following my father's footsteps. I became a bricklayer. I did it for 39 years. I'll tell you what, it's a great job if you like to drink. My job didn't make me an alcoholic. It had nothing to do with it, but it was always there. It was always there. And if you like to drink, it's always there. And I pretty much, right out of high school, I became a daily drinker. I married a girl. She happens to be here tonight. Her parents owned a bar. I met her in that bar. I was eating our lunch in there one Saturday afternoon. Blonde-haired, green-eyed, and I'll tell you what, buddy, she was a cutie pie. I ended up marrying that girl. They used to let us work in there on Saturday nights, me and her. I remember I told a guy at work one time, my wife and I were going to start tending a bar on Saturday nights. This guy said, kid, that's going to be like letting a rabbit guard the lettuce. Wonderful. But you know that my whole thing with this drinking thing, I never had any, what I refer to as consequences. We were talking last night, but I never had any consequences with the law. I never lost my job over my drinking. I never had a DUI because of my drinking. My wife never served me with divorce papers over my drinking. I didn't have any consequences. Here, the only consequence that I had, and I realized this early on, was that once I started drinking, I couldn't stop. Once I started, I couldn't stop. My wife and I were just married. We weren't married very long, maybe a couple years. And this August 1st, we'll be married 39 years. I used to get her a coin every year. She told me to stop it. Yeah, that's a fact. Yeah. But anyway, we got married, and I used to tell myself, I'd get up in the morning and I'd say, I'm not going to drink today. I'm not going to drink today. I'm not going to drink today. And you know what? Most of the time I could make it all day long. I could make it all day. But on the way coming home from work, I had one of those trucks that had a mind on its own. It would pull right into her mom's bar. I made it my home bar. I got very active. I showed up early and I stayed late. And I would go in there, and this was long before. We got married in 1980, so it was in the very early 80s before cell phones come out. I would walk into that bar, and I would have a quarter. And I would go over to the payphone, and I would drop it into the phone, and I would dial the number. And this is what my wife would hear on the other end of the phone. And this is also a fill in the blanks. Right? I would say, hi, honey, it's me. I'm not getting drunk tonight. I'm going to have one beer, no more than two. I said that, and I meant it. I said it, and I meant it. I'm going to have one beer, no more than two. I should be home at 6:30, no later than. It's good to have a plan. It's good to have a plan. I said that, and I meant it. And I left precisely at 1 when they closed. Over and over and over. And I would come back home, and after I promised her I wasn't going to get drunk, I wasn't going to do it, I wasn't going to do it, time after time again. And I can remember coming home one night, and she had big tears in her eyes, and she looked at me and she said, Chad, you promised. You promised. Why? And it's the first time that I can really remember ever telling her the truth about my drinking. When she asked me why, I said, I don't know. I don't know. I knew nothing about that allergy that Dr. Silkworth talks about in the big book. Once I put alcohol in my system, I'm off and running. And you know, how come, why is it that I'm the type of guy where I want more after the third beer than I want after the first? I want more after the fifth beer than I want after the third. I want more after the tenth beer than I want after the seventh. I never got enough. I always got served too much. But I never got enough. More was better. More was better. We were married for a long time. Like I said, I never had any consequences. I never had any trouble. But I knew I had a problem and I didn't know what to do. 30 years ago, I asked a guy who's sitting down here in the front row down over here, I said, I'm working with him. And I knew that this gentleman had just gotten into Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew he didn't drink. And I didn't know anything about AA or anything like that. I just knew that he didn't drink. And 30 years ago, I asked this guy, I said, Mike, do you think I might have a drinking problem? And I don't remember one word that he said, but I remember asking 30 years ago. And if you got to ask, something's wrong. 30 years ago, do you think I might have a drinking problem? 15 years later, I asked this guy. It's funny because me and him were, I was the bricklayer foreman and he was the labor foreman. But you got to understand, it was only me and him on the job. Alcoholism, beef it up, make it sound good. I'm just a knucklehead bricklayer and he's just my labor. But I'm the bricklayer foreman and he's the labor foreman. But you know, I remember asking him this. I said, Mike, do you think I might be an alcoholic? And he said, I don't know. I never drank with you. I said, wait a minute. Do you think I might be an alcoholic? He said, I don't know. I never drank with you. He said, Chad, it's not what time you start drinking. It's not for how long you drink. It's not what you drink, who you drink with, where you drink that makes you an alcoholic. What makes you an alcoholic is what happens to you after you take the first drink. And he said, I've never drank with you. He said, it's obvious you're a heavy drinker. I could live with that. I could go home and tell my wife, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm a heavy drinker. I heard it from an alcoholic. An alcoholic told me that I'm a heavy drinker. And you know what? I can rationalize and justify that. I mean, while I'm getting in this trouble and starting to get some of these consequences and some of this stuff and everything like that, I was a heavy drinker and a victim of unusual circumstances. It was never my fault. It was never my fault. My drinking had got to the point where, take it right up to my last drunk, June the 20th. It was my daughter's 16th birthday. My wife had a big party planned out for him. They had a pavilion at the Portage Lakes Eagles, which is an Eagles club down the road. They had the pavilion and the whole spread in case it would rain. It was the most beautiful day of the year. Sun was shining. They didn't want me there. They didn't want me there. They knew I would show up drunk. I promised them that I wouldn't show up drunk. Guess what? I showed up drunk. They left me in charge of one thing and one thing only. They left me in charge of a bonfire. How do you screw up a bonfire? I had a bunch of pallets I'd taken from work. I left at noon on the 20th. I left at noon to prepare for this bonfire. I'm driving around and I'm stealing pallets off of these job strike construction sites, and I must have made 15, 20 trips, and every time I would go get a load of wood, I got a bottle of Little Sid's gin and juice. A fifth of Little Sid's gin and juice. I had it between my legs, and I'd go get another load and everything like that. Make a long story short, guess what? I showed up drunk. She didn't want me there. She didn't want me there. I don't know how they did it because I was drunk, but they ended up moving the party inside to get away from me. And I tried to go inside, and the guy that was running the place told me, she don't want you in here, and if you come in, she's going to have you arrested. I suggest you just go home, take a shower, and sleep it off. I'm walking back to my truck, and I'm looking at that big pile of wood. I had wood stacked. I don't know how I got it that high, but it was high. My first thought was, I'm not leaving that wood for nobody. So I started my own bonfire. And I had me one heck of a good fire going on. And all the trash was sitting on the picnic tables, and all the stuff was, you know, and you know how we alcoholics are, when we screw up, we'll try to fix it a little bit. So I burn up all the trash. And I went home, and I passed out, and I took a shower. And I woke up the next morning, and there beside my wallet is a note. Now, I'm at the stage of my drinking career where I'm not getting notes to tell me what a good husband I am, what a good father I am, what a good son I am. Now, you get notes when you screw up. I was working at downtown Akron at the Akron Art Museum. I was in charge of that project. I was the foreman on that job. Got about halfway to work, and I read that note. Guess what? Come to find out, not only did I burn up all the trash, I burn up all the leftover paper plates. I burn up all the leftover cups, knives, spoons, forks. I burn up all my daughter's birthday presents, and I burn up all my daughter's birthday money. And my daughter left me a note. On this note, it said, you're a drunk, and I don't want you to be my dad no more. I got to work, and I started walking a little bit north into the west. And in Akron here, we have a thing, it's called the High Level Bridge. And my intent was walking towards that bridge was that I was going to walk out there in the middle of that bridge and I was going to throw myself over the side. I made it out there on that bridge. The sun's coming up. It's hot. I'm sweating. I'm miserable and I'm dying. I'm looking over the side of that bridge and I'm trying to muster up enough courage to jump. But I got to tell you what, I got to be honest with you. I'm a coward. I knew I wasn't going to jump. I'm a coward, and I knew that I wanted to jump so bad. I wanted to jump so bad. I'm looking over the side of that bridge, and I'm looking. I bet if I counted 1,001, 1,002, 1,003, that by 1,008, the hurt would go away, and that's all I wanted. I just wanted the hurt to go away. I don't know if I had a moment of clarity or what they said, but the next thing you know, I pulled my cell phone out. And I called my wife and I said, Christy, I need help and I don't know what to do. And you know what she said? You know what she said? Oh my God, my prayers have been answered. You don't think you got prayed into that seat? You don't think you got prayed into that seat? You, me? You got prayed where you're at right now today, whether you like it or not. And I'm on strict assignment from both of my sponsors to keep sending those prayers up for that sick and suffering alcoholic, because you just never know when the miracle might start. She said, you're going to get a phone call from this guy, and he's going to help you. And I did. I got a phone call from a guy named Bill. I knew Bill didn't drink, but I didn't know that he was in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, I hear you're having some problems, and we've been waiting for you to call, and you think you cannot drink today? And I said, yeah. And I went over to his house that night. When I got ready to leave, I don't remember too much what he said, other than the fact that he said, "Would you like to go to a meeting tomorrow night?" And I told my first lie in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, "I would love to. I would love to." I didn't want to go to no meeting, and I didn't want to talk to nobody, and I didn't want to. I just wanted that hurt to go away. The hurt that was in here and the hurt that I'd done to everybody in my life. I just wanted that hurt to go away. I went to a meeting that next night. It was a men's meeting. I don't remember anything that happened. I stayed sober. I didn't drink. I didn't drink on Tuesday. I didn't drink on Wednesday. And we went to that meeting on Wednesday, and I didn't drink. And I went home, and I remember my wife. She said, like, "Well, what do you think?" And I said, "I don't know. But I'm going to go back. I'm going to go back." Now, my second meeting, I remember. My second meeting that I went to was on the Friday night. Right? They were having a big pizza party. They were having this huge pizza party at this Friday night meeting, and I walked in there, and lo and behold, it was like old homecoming week for me. There's a guy that I went to school with. There's my seventh grade basketball coach, Coach Klein, and there's my grade school bus driver all sitting in there. I got three people that I knew from when I was a kid all the way growing up and everything like that. We had a pizza party. They've asked if anybody was new to Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, "This is my second meeting." I got a standing ovation, and they gave me a big book. Now, I'll tell you what, for your second meeting, that's kind of impressive, because not only do you, I figured out very early on, you got a meal, a banquet meal of pizza, I got a prize, the big book, and I got a standing ovation, all for burning my life to the ground. And I thought, this is good, I'll go back. And you know what? I did. I kept going back. But I went back for one reason and one reason only. My wife was happy. My daughter was happy. I had been sober about a week, and she wrote me this card, and I saved this card. I still have it. She said, "Dad, this decision you've made has already changed our lives." I didn't make no decision. I just didn't drink for a couple days. I just didn't drink. So to me, early on, the answer is just don't drink. So that's what I did. I started working for the first 6 months. I call it the Chad Spahr Program of Recovery. It's called Don't Drink, Don't Go to Meetings, and Don't Do Nothing Else. It's not good. It's not good. It's not good. I would go to this meeting called Morning Meditation, and on one side of the wall over there, they had the promises, and on the other side, they had the steps. This is also in the Chad Spahr Program of Recovery. I come up with the bright idea, I'm going to work those promises and hope them steps come true. I want to comprehend the word serenity. I want to know peace. I want that feeling of uselessness to go. I don't want to do no work. I don't want to make no inventory, and I sure as heck don't want to tell nobody about it. I want the rewards, but I don't want to do no work. And you know what? I stayed sober for the first 6 months. I'll tell you what, I was miserable. I was miserable. Because here's what it is, and I'm going to say this one time, and I'll probably get in trouble, but I don't care. What happens when you quit drinking? What happens when you quit drinking? You're sober. When you quit drinking, you are sober. You're sober at a job that still stinks, a wife that still nags, two kids that are still brats, a boss that's like a diaper. Well, what about them guys you got to work with? But you're sober. You're sober. It didn't take me long to figure out in the Chad Spahr Program of Recovery, drinking's not my problem. Sober's my problem. I don't like how I feel when I'm sober. And I'm going to say this one time. Sober sucks. I don't like how I feel when I'm sober. That's why I drank. Drinking was not my problem. Drinking was my answer. Remember, taller, stronger, better looking, better. I don't like how I feel when I'm sober. I stayed sober for the first 6 months, white knuckling it. A couple days before Christmas, we had shut down for the winter. I go to this Tuesday morning meeting that they always had over there, and it was run by an old guy who's no longer with us. His name was Paul Sipe, and I called it the Paul Sipe meeting. I don't even know if it had a name. Everybody called it the Paul Sipe meeting. I walk into that Paul Sipe meeting, and there's like 700 years of recovery in that room. There's Jim Strahan. There's Walter Crooks. There's Jimmy Hill. There's Paul Sipe. all five of the Hicken brothers are in there. And if you don't know who the Hicken brothers are, they go from like 49 years to 39 years. There's like 200 and some years. They're all in there. Betty Birkins, Linda Moyers, Patty Sweet, I call them my AA moms. And everybody's having a ball, and everybody's just having, and I'm dying. I'm dying because I'm sober. And I sat down next to this gentleman who's no longer with us. This is 13 and a half years ago. And I looked at Jim and I said, Jim, what am I doing wrong? And Jim said, what are you doing right? And I said, well, I'm not drinking and I'm going to meetings. He said, Chad, we know that drinking's not your problem. We know that drinking's your answer. We're not asking you to lay down your problem. We're asking you to lay down your answer. And if we don't give you something bigger and better than the answer, you're going to go right back to drinking. And about that time, somebody said, maybe you should write him the prescription. Write him the prescription. And old Jim walked with a cane, and he got up kind of slow and everything like that, and he walked over, and he was gone a couple minutes, and he come back, and he sat down across from me, and he slid this piece of paper across, and he had his hand on it like this, and he said, son, this is your medicine. If you take your medicine, you'll get well, I promise. I did not save that piece of paper because at the time it didn't have any meaning. The prescription. He wrote me the prescription, and I turned it over, and guess what it said? Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. No steps, no program. No program, no recovery. He explained to me the difference between the fellowship and the program. He said, the fellowship is great. The fellowship is great. It's going to the lead meetings. It's eating the stale donuts, drinking the bad coffee, checking out the chicks. It's wonderful. But he said the fellowship is there for one reason only. The fellowship is there to support us. It's not enough to change us. And if nothing changes, nothing changes. I called that guy. I called that guy that I asked 30-some years ago, and then 15 years later, I called him and I said, you know, Mike, I haven't drank in 6 months, and they suggested I get a sponsor. Will you be my sponsor? And he said, I will on two conditions. Number one, you call me every day. And number two, he said, every time you go to a meeting, I want you to try to take somebody with you. And if you do that, I promise you something big's going to happen. And I looked at him and I said, what? He said, I don't know. But I promise you, something big's going to happen if you just take those guys to a meeting. What? He goes, I don't know. But I promise you something big's going to happen. He said, I suggest you get active at a treatment center and everything like that. I did. I found this treatment center. It's the Salvation Army that's down here, and I got very, very active on it early on. And a little guy named Eddie asked me if I'd start taking him to meetings, and I started doing that. And at the time, Mike was a part-time cab driver, and he worked late at night, and on the way going home from dropping these guys off, he would always ask me, he'd say, how many guys you take to a meeting? I'd say, took four. He goes, Attaboy, you just keep dragging them drunks around, and I promise you something big's going to happen. And I'd say, well, what? He'd go, I don't know. I promise you, if you just keep dragging them drunks around. My daughter had an old Malibu. I have to find out what year it was. It was one of them old-style cars with the big back seat and everything like that. And she would let me take that Malibu to the Salvation Army, and I would load that car up. You could fit four guys in the back, three in the front, and one in the trunk. Took a guy to a meeting, we pulled in there one morning, there was eight guys, had room for seven, and I told him, I said, Chris, hop in the trunk, we'll get your ride back, and he did. And I had to, a couple days later, Mike said something about, you take any guys in meetings? I said, three in the back, or four in the back, three in the front, one in the trunk. He said, you put a guy in the trunk? This is what he said. He said, I'm not sure if it's AA approved, but I'm pretty sure you get double God's grace for putting a guy in a trunk and taking him to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. You know, I kept waiting for that something big. I kept waiting for that something big. Something big was going to happen. I had them knuckleheads from the Salvation Army at the meeting one time, and the lady was leading. I have no idea where it was at. I don't even remember. But this is, and I wasn't really even paying attention. But I heard her say this. She said, if you're willing to help others, if you're just willing to help others, God will grant you the greatest gift that he could ever grant an alcoholic. She said, you will achieve a quiet mind and a loving heart. A quiet mind and a loving heart. I excused myself from that meeting. I went outside and I called Mike and everything like that. And I said, hey, Suck, I think I found that something big. And he said, what is it? I said, a quiet mind and a loving heart. Is that it? And he went, I don't know, but you just keep dragging them drunks around and I promise you something big's going to happen. A quiet mind and a loving heart. That's what you people have shown me. That's what you people have shown me. It's a beautiful way to live. There's an old guy down in Canton. He's no longer with us. He was blind. His name was Joe Rudolph. And Joe looked at me one day and he said, Chad, if God made anything better than Alcoholics Anonymous, he kept it for himself, because I can't think of a more beautiful way to live. I can't. I can't. You know, I'm going to read this out of the big book real quick, and then I'm going to tell you two quick stories and we'll go. The gentleman over here that was taping me, he told me, he said, once you start talking, he said, you have 75 minutes. I got you. No, we're almost done. But I'm going to read this. I'm going to read this because when I heard this done, it changed my life. All right? I'm going to read you this. It's on page 52. It says, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. Anybody having any problems with personal relationships? We can't control our emotional natures. You got that? We were prey to misery and depression. You got a little misery and you got a little depression? Can't make a living. You got that? You have a feeling of uselessness. Do you have that feeling of uselessness? Full of fear. You got some fear? You were unhappy. You got that? You can't really seem to be of real help to other people. They told me to take your finger and stick it on page 52 and hold it right there. And they said, turn to page 83. And they ask you some more questions. If you are painstaking about this phase of your development, you're going to be amazed before you're halfway through. You're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. Would you like that? You're not going to regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. You're going to comprehend this word serenity, and you will know peace. You want that? No matter how far down that scale you've gone, you will see how your experience can benefit others. Would you like that feeling of uselessness and self-pity to disappear? Do you want to lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in your fellows? Would you like the self-seeking to slip away? Do you want your whole attitude and outlook on life to change? How about this one? You want the fear of people and economic insecurity to leave you? Would you intuitively like to know how to handle situations that used to baffle you? Would you suddenly like to realize that God is doing for you what you couldn't do for yourself? If you got what's on page 52 and you want what's on page 83, just do what lies in between. It's that simple. I call it the meat and the potatoes of my program of recovery. It's only 30 short pages. And I wanted those promises. I wanted those promises. And slowly but surely, they started coming true. If you got what's on page 52 and you want what's on page 84, do the deal. My sponsor, Harmon, calls it doing the deal. Just do the deal. I'll tell you what, this alcoholism that I deal with, I'm going to tell you a couple things what it's like today. The ism. I, self, me. I was at the Salvation Army a couple years ago as we're doing some four-step work with a guy. My wife called on the way going out. She said, would you do me a favor? Absolutely. She said, would you stop and pick me up a cake mix? I would love to. What flavor do you want? She says, we're going to a birthday party. Really doesn't matter. I've got all kind of icings. You pick. I walk in the grocery store. No normal person would pick chocolate, white, or yellow. I pick pineapple. Who picks pineapple? Who picks an alcoholic? I get my pineapple cake. I walk up to the thing. The store had just opened. I'm the only one in there. I go to the 12 aisles or 12 items or less. The guy in front of me has 17 items. I know. I counted them twice. Now, remember, I walked out of that Salvation Army after doing some four-step work and some praying with this guy and everything like that. Nobody's going to push my buttons. Nothing's going to happen. But I'm standing there in line, and I'm counting his stuff, and here's what I want to do. I want to flick that switch off. I want the belt to stop. I want to grab that microphone. I want to call the manager up. I want the manager to count his stuff. I want the manager to scold him and say, "What the hell is wrong with you? Can't you see this?" And all out of the blue, this guy looks at me and he goes like that. He goes, "Hey, kid, you just got one item? Go ahead." And I go, "That's all right, buddy. I'm in no hurry. I'll just stand here and wait. I'll just true story. I'll just stand here and wait." That's my disease. I'm important. I'm special. Doesn't he know where I need to be? I had nowhere to go, and I had nothing else to do. And that thought went through my head. Here's my big struggle that I've been working on for a year. Where you guys are from and everything like that, I'm sure everybody's heard of it. Everybody got a Circle K in their neighborhood. Everybody got a Circle K. They got these things called Polar Pops. Everybody knows about the Polar Pop. Best deal in town, 99 cents. All right? I know what I'm going to get. For the last 10 years, I've gotten a full throttle thrust. I know what I'm getting. And I walk up there, when I walk in, and the first thing I do is I stand there and I get my cup and I give that sign. What am I going to get? And I try a little bit of Coke, and I try a little bit of 7-Up, and I try a little bit of Fruit Punch, and I try 6 or 7. I've already drank a half a Polar Pop, knowing what I'm going to get. And then I finally fill my cup up with the Polar Pop, with the full throttle, got my straw in hand and the lid ready, and I get it all the way up till it's just ready to lip out, and I stick that straw in there, and I suck it up as fast and as hard as I can till I get the brain freeze. And then I fill it back up. Now what I'm doing here, I'm just waiting. I'm just waiting for somebody to come up behind me, tap me on the shoulder and go, "You're an alcoholic, aren't you?" Because that's what we do. Maybe you don't. Maybe none of you spiritual giants do that, but I'll tell you what, buddy. Oh yeah, I catch myself a lot. You know, it's been an honor and a privilege to be able to share with you people today, especially being the opening speaker. I'll tell you, I've got to tell you this because it's been a major, major, major part of my story. I have two sponsors. I have Mike Sahudka, who's sitting out here, the guy that was my labor foreman when he was the only labor there. But it sounds good. It sounds good. That Mike that I asked to be my sponsor, you know, I got him in my corner. But I need that. Mike lives in Willoughby, that's like maybe 55, 60 miles away. And I need that hometown sponsor. I need that guy that I can see eyeball to eyeball, one-on-one, a couple times a week or whatever like that. Knows when I'm lying. Knows when I'm feeding him bull, when I'm not doing what I'm supposed to. And I got that hometown sponsor. His name is Harmon Feeling. And I am so blessed to have both those guys in my life. Harmon and Mike had never met. Harmon was speaking up in Cleveland a couple years ago, and I knew they knew about each other, and I'm not that guy. I do not use one against the other and everything like that. I'm just very blessed to have two of the most powerful examples that God's ever placed in my life, you know, in my corner. But Harmon was going to speak up in Cleveland, and Mike had said, "Hey, I think your buddy Harmon's speaking up there." So we went and we had breakfast. Well, to make a long story short, when we were all done and everything like that, we had somebody take our picture. And I brought this picture, and I'm not a proc comic or anything. I could go by props, but I'll set it over here, and you can look at it. Because what I did was I took this picture with Mike and Harmon and myself, and I blew it up. I had copies made, and I sent one, each one of them, one for Christmas. They both sent back very, very, very grateful, thoughtful thank you letters. But Mike said the most profound thing. He said, "You look at that picture, and you look at these smiles." And Mike said, "Only God and Alcoholics Anonymous could put smiles on three drunks' faces that big. Only God and Alcoholics Anonymous could put smiles that big on three knuckleheads' faces. I'm the most blessed guy in the world. I'm the most blessed guy in the world. I learned from Harmon, you know. Harmon told me a long time ago, it's all good. I would say it's all good. And you know what Harmon would say? Drop an O. It's all God. It's all God. It's all good. It's all God. Living a dream. Harmon, look, I'd see him at the Salvation Army, walk in and ring again, how you doing? And he'd say, I said, how you doing? He said, I'm living a dream. Never thought my life could be like this. I'm living a dream. And here's the big one that Harmon taught me and everything like that. I don't have to, I get to. I don't have to, I get to. Now, if you don't remember this have to and get to, that's a blessing in itself. You know, a have to attitude. A have to attitude is the enemy of a get to spirit. I get to. But more importantly today, I don't have to and I don't even get to. I do it today because I want to. I want to. And that's not me. That's my higher power working in my life. You know, back in October, Aaron had sent me a text and everything like that, and he said, we would like for you to speak at Founders Day. And I said, well, I gotta pray about it, and I gotta call my sponsor, because that's what they tell you to do in sponsorship school. Pray about it and then call your sponsor. Because that was like, so when you call your sponsor and he says, would you pray about it? Yeah. All right. And I called you and everything like that. And I did. You know what? I went into the chapel where I work and I just sat down there for a minute. And I didn't even do no praying, because I already got the answer. And I went out and I picked up the phone. It was on a Saturday. And I called Harmon. And I said, Harmon, I have graciously been asked to lead at Founders Day. And he said, was that a problem? And I said, kind of, sort of. It's a long time between October and June. And all this is going to do is feed my ego. All it's going to do is feed my ego. He said, do you want to do it? And I said, I do. I really do. And he said, well, here's the two conditions. He told me the first condition, and I don't even remember what it was. But I remember the second one. He said, you got to mention your sponsor's name a lot. That's a fact. That's a fact. But you know the reason why this, I told him, I said, it's a long time in this ego stuff and everything like that, and that's my disease. And he said, you know what? Now we've got something to work with. We've got something to work on. All right? Harmon and I reconnected. We got back together. He does a big book study on Wednesday nights, and we got connected and everything like that. And he has helped me immensely with this ego reduction at depth. And that's what this is all about. We had breakfast a couple weeks ago on a Thursday. We had breakfast, and I sent him a text afterwards, and I said, hey, I remember the second thing, mention your name. And he said, I said, what was the first thing? And he sent me back the most profound thing. You know what it said? When you go up there to speak, express, don't try to impress. And you know what? I'll tell you what, the last couple weeks have been wonderful. I have been very excited. I have been very, very excited. The nervousness and everything had went. Express, don't try to impress. And then I run into this guy last Saturday, and I told him that. And by the way, if anybody on the committee ever asks you if they can tape your lead or whatever like that, there's a good chance you're going to be up here at this podium, because they interview and they do auditions and all the other stuff that goes with it. And I was telling him about it. Express, not impress. And he said, you know what? Just tell your story like you told it when we taped you. Because that's what we wanted to hear. I don't know if I did. I don't know if I did and not and everything like that. But I'll tell you what, two things. It has been an honor and a privilege to be able to speak at the 84th Founders Day. That's number one. Number two, I can never get back what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. I can never repay. I can never repay in my mind. And both of those sponsors, and everything like that, say, just keep trying to help people.
Hold on to your butt cheeks because you're going to be in for the ride of your life, man. You think it's good now? Just hold on because it's only going to get better. And number three and the best part, I'm done. And I can enjoy this weekend for the rest of it. I want to thank you people for allowing me to share. I want to thank you so much. God bless you. Thank you.